This is Ken, and we're back at Wormhole Riders You Decide in the studio with Agam Darshi, the director of Fade Out. At this point, I'm going to ask Patricia Stewart-Bertrand to ask some questions so I can send out some tweets. If you could pick up where we left off, Patricia, I'd appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. And Agam, yes, you were talking about that you had gone to university and you were taking theater. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened afterwards that got you into acting?
Yeah, so I minored in theater, but I majored in visual arts, and that was really what I was thinking my life path was going to be, was to become a visual artist. And I moved to Vancouver from Calgary, and I had a teacher, an old teacher in Calgary, who was like, well, since you're moving to Vancouver and there's a lot of things that end up being shot up there, you might want to consider getting an agent. And so I decided to do that. I really thought it was perhaps going to be like a part-time thing, but I ended up booking the first show that I went out for, and it was like three episodes on a TV show called RenegadePress.com. And then, you know, 4 months later, I was being flown to LA to screen test for something. So it was really like a very fast process that I didn't realize at the time how rare that was. But it felt kind of like something I fell into. And then, you know, soon I really became very serious about it. And it's my career now, you know.
Okay. And yes, and you're doing quite well at it. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up with Crystal Bow and Oprah Browder with Fade Out?
Yeah, I mean, Crystal is from Vancouver. We both kind of knew each other from going to auditions and stuff like that. And she was a friend of Sandy Seydoux's, who was a good friend of mine. And so we just met one day. We had lunch in L.A., and, you know, she was mentioning how she wanted to produce. And I told her how I wanted to direct. And I'm like, you know, I have a script, so if this is something that's of interest to you, perhaps we can work on it. And so she agreed. She read the script. She liked it. She agreed. And then she brought Sandy on board. And it was really just a really great experience, you know, because for all three of us, we were actors who were learning how to do something else. So I had never directed before, and they had never produced before. So it was kind of a perfect scenario.
Okay, and how did Ona Grauer end up with you guys?
So I had never, like, I knew Ona from Vancouver, and I knew her work, and I knew who she was, but I'd never really met her before. And so when we were thinking about casting choices and stuff for this character, she was really the first person that came to mind because, I mean, she's stunning. She's so beautiful, and the role of the woman in the film is basically about an actress who is kind of falling apart, and it's the night of her film premiere. And so it goes back and forth between fantasy and reality, and I really wanted an actress who was very, very beautiful, and but also a little bit older, and not, you know, 50s or anything, but definitely not somebody in their 20s. And Ana definitely has a very, like, womanly look, and she's very stunning. And so we just decided that we'd ask her, and she knew Crystal. And she read the script, and she really loved it, and she decided to come on board.
Okay. Where are you in the production process? Is it complete, ready to go?
Yeah, it's totally done. It's very exciting.
Do you have an air date for it?
No, not yet. So basically, it's 100% done. We're just delivering it to Bravo this week, this upcoming week, and then they will place it. They will air it on their website and possibly their network. I'm not exactly sure when, but as soon as I know, I'll let everybody else know.
Okay, we'll look forward to that.
Yes, I can't wait.
You've done script writing before. You've told us about that. What's the hardest part of the craft for you?
Oh, my goodness. Screenwriting is one of the loneliest things that you can do. It's really actually quite awful. It's I don't know. I feel like unless there's an idea inside your head that's just bursting to come out, that's really what it takes to write a script, because otherwise you're just locking yourself in a room and you're by yourself, and it's such a difficult process because you don't really have anyone to, initially, to bounce off ideas. You're just kind of there alone with your computer. And I personally, I love writing shorts. I've done a number of them and made the films and stuff like that, and I really love that process. But when you're writing a feature, it feels like you're wrestling with a monster. It's just such a long process, and there's so many elements at play, and everything kind of needs to add up. So it's very, very long and arduous, and actually really awful. But at the end of the day, you end up having a script that can be really beautiful, and it's all worth it. I guess it's like going through labor, although I've never had kids, so I don't know, but that's what I would probably think it would be like.
Yeah, it can be pretty tough, both of those things.
Yeah, it's like 9 months of caring.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and watching your book go through changes you didn't think were possible.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Kate was a really great character in Sanctuary, so let's talk a little bit about Sanctuary. Would you reprise your role if the series came back?
Yeah, I love Kate. I think if the series came back, though, she would have changed a lot. I mean, she already had quite an arc throughout the three seasons that I did the show. And so I think if the show came back, or if they did a film or whatever, I think Kate would be, she would always have that kind of sassiness quality, but I think she would be quite different. You know, she was kind of entering into her womanhood, so I'd be really curious as to what she'd be like if the series did come back or if they did a film.
Yes, definitely. It would be nice to see her having grown quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to segue in here with a question that is a little tongue-in-cheek, but and then turn the mic back over to Patricia. As Kate, were you, Henry Foss, and Biggie ever successful in stopping Tesla from raiding Helen Magnus's wine cellar, Agam?
I don't think anybody's successful at stopping Tesla from raiding the wine cellar. That was a really beautiful detail. That's something about the show that I really loved, was just the details of the different characters, the little quirks. And I think that's the reason why fans loved it so much, was because, you know, you have people like Tesla who just love wine, and then you have somebody like Biggie and Kate, and their relationship was a little bit, you know, not that great at the beginning, but then they became really close friends. So it's those little quirks, I think, that are so special.
Well, we know that Jonathan Young, we had the honor of interviewing you at the MCM Expo in London in 2011.
Yeah.
So he's a great actor, and he played Tesla to the T, you know. I mean, gosh.
Amazing, yeah. I've also seen Jonathan in doing theater in a few different shows, and he's just like so beautiful to watch. Like he's just a really, really good actor and a really lovely person.
Well, this is off the record before I turn it back to Patricia, but in the new Sanctuary that we saw at the very end of part two, Patricia wrote that analysis. I understand that Dr. Magnus had Henry Foss put a force field around the wine cellar this time, so. Tesla's going to have to behave himself.
Well, that's good. That's important.
I'm going to go back and let Patricia talk more about Kate. I loved Kate. She grew so much. But Patricia, please go ahead, and thanks for letting me segue in with a little humor and levity here.
Okay, sure. Kate Freelander replaced Amelia Ullerup's character, mm-hmm. who was killed off. Did you face any backlash as a result?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Well, just in terms of, I was really, really out of the loop when we were shooting. Like, I really didn't, I actually didn't know that Amelia's character, that Ashley, was going to be gone forever. And so when she was killed off, I mean, it's sci-fi, so I really thought that she was going to probably come back, or they're going to, you know, something. I did not have it in my head that my character was actually replacing her character. And I don't think anybody ever really treated Kate like that either, or treated me like that. So when we had done and finished shooting the first, or this season that I was on, I had such a great time shooting, and I loved it. And then it was airing, and I just, all I heard was all these fans who hated my character, and I really kind of took it personally as to, you know, the fact that I was on the show. So I was getting hate mail for a while, which was really difficult, because I was not expecting it at all. But then now, just kind of being a part of the sci-fi world for, you know, these last few years, I realized just how passionate people are of the shows that they love and of the characters that they love. So it makes more sense to me. But back then, I had no idea. And then it wasn't really until probably halfway, like, I guess my character, Kate, started in season two. So at the very beginning, when it first started airing, there was a lot of hate. And then about halfway, there were people that were turning, and they were like, wait a minute, Kate's not such a bad character. And then by the end of season two, I think there was a lot more love for her. And then definitely by season three, I felt like Kate kind of got a lot more fans out there, which was really exciting. But at the beginning, for sure, the fact that the way they killed off Ashley as well was pretty, I could understand, like, it was pretty harsh. And then having, you know, Kate kind of come in and replace her that quickly in that way, I mean, it's an adjustment for sure. I can understand that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Did you have any input into your Sanctuary character's development?
No, not at first. I think at first it was just kind of like, okay, so this is the character, here you go. And so I played her the way it was written. And then I think it was probably more season three, where it's not that I necessarily had input, but the writers were really smart, and they were just kind of play off of the relationships that we would have in real life and kind of write that in. And so at the very beginning, actually, they wanted Will and Kate to have a kind of connection, perhaps like a romance or a possible romance. But the thing is that I think they probably saw how me and Ryan Robbins were in real life, and we have like a real good camaraderie and a good friendship. And so they started writing more for that. So by the time that that one episode, I'm so bad with episode names, but the one where Kate's a superhero, she ends up kissing Henry. That was actually changed from Will to Henry, because I think just in terms of how Ryan and I are in real life, like we're just friends and stuff, they really wanted to kind of write that more in. So I didn't necessarily have a direct say in how Kate changed, but they kind of just took things from real life and then added that into the seasons.
Okay, for me, this is a bit of a pet peeve that I have, that I've had for quite some time, because it seems that there's a bit of a fashion these days for writers to kill off a major character in a series to up the stakes for the drama. As a fan of science fiction shows, I just find this concept very irritating. What's your opinion about that, and how do you feel about when they kill off a character?
That's a really good question. I guess as like an actor, you never want to go to work and then realize that your character has been killed. You know, like you want to know that you have a little bit of, like, if you're a lead in the show, that you're going to be there. But that being said, I mean, it definitely brings audiences back when they're not sure, you know, like there's something really, really interesting about creating a world where even your main heroes and heroines are not safe and that anything can happen, because it kind of ups the stakes a little bit. And it also stops episodes from being the same every single time, or like they're like, okay, well, they solved that crime and back again next week, or this close to dying, but they didn't. You know, so I don't know. There's something that I think is really ballsy about killing off characters, like lead characters. But at the same time, I mean, you really have to take into account the fact that you have an audience there that fall in love with the characters that are written. And it's almost not fair to them, because it's not just about the show and about the ratings and all of that. It's the fact that you're almost creating real-life people and real-life characters almost, and that there are people out there that tune in every single week to watch them. And then when you kill them off, you're really just, I don't know, it's almost like an emotional tie that you're kind of cutting between the audience and the show and the audience and the characters. So it has to be, I guess it just has to be something that can't be done too often, and that has to be really, really considered properly before they do that. I didn't quite understand why Biggie was killed off at the end of season, of the very last season. And maybe he was going to come back if there was a season 5, but I don't know if that was really, really necessary. So, yeah, I'm really on the fence about it. I mean, yeah, I don't know if I really answered that question, but I'm on the fence.
For me, there's a danger involved in doing something like that, because if it becomes a common occurrence in most sci-fi shows that people are, that no one is safe, basically, then why would the fans work on creating an emotional bond with that particular character to just have that character ripped away from them? Where is the desire? You know, why would I as a fan want to see my interest in that particular show become that emotionally involved if there's a danger that that character that I've grown to love is taken away? And if that's the case, then the fans don't become quite as enamored of the series as perhaps they would if they really liked a character. And you run the danger of losing the fan base because that's happening.
I totally see where you're coming from, and I really agree. And, you know, it's funny because I also think that the fans that watch sci-fi they're just different from fans that watch other types of shows. You know, they really do care and follow and love the characters that they watch. Whereas, you know, something like that happening on, like, you know, let's say a CSI or whatever, it's just not as, I don't know if it's quite as important or as, it doesn't really hurt as much as when you're watching a sci-fi show and you're a sci-fi fan. So I totally see where you're coming from.
Okay, let's move on.
Yes, I have some questions specifically. I'd like to get back to Fade Out a little bit here. But first, you know, on the death of characters, Michael Shanks played Dr. Jackson, and they killed him off. But actually, it was because he wanted some time with Lexa Doig, who was there raising a family. And there was a huge uproar about, you know, Dr. Jackson being killed off. And, of course, they brought him back at the end of season 6, and he stayed with the series through 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then the two movies. Are you a fan of Doctor Who, by any chance, Agam?
No, you know what? I've never watched Doctor Who.
Okay. Well,
it's great.
Let me cut that out, but... That series dealt with the death of the character differently, where the Doctor was regenerated and has been played by, I think, 10 or 11 actors over the 50-year run. This is the 50th year of anniversary of Doctor Who. So they would get rid of an actor, probably to help keep costs down, but the Doctor always lived. And he would come back as a new person, regenerated by the TARDIS, and so there are some solutions.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost like James Bond, you know, like you can have this timeless, this person, this character that people really believe in and love and follow, but it's just the actors that change. And so I really like that, actually.
Well, I know we were involved with MGM, and I knew that Shanks was coming back, but I was sworn to secrecy. And, you know, when they brought his character back, all the fans cheered. So it's a tough thing to kill off a character like what was done with Emily's character, Ms. Ulep's character.
Yeah, it really is. And like I said, I mean, I think people are just so much more invested in sci-fi shows. And so that bond that's created between characters and the fans, I think is stronger than I've seen in anything else that I've ever done.
Well, we saw a lot of, quote, you know, in quotes, hate tweets. But you and Emily are actually good friends, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, we never really knew each other that well. And then we ended up going to Dragon Con last year and having to do these panels together. And we were both kind of laughing about it because it's just, like, there's been so much drama about our characters and about who we are as people and why she was left the show and why I was on the show. So it was really fun, actually, to be able to be up there and to kind of just, like, get to the bottom of it and to really talk to people frankly about what happened. And also just kind of playing around. Like, she's really, I don't know if you've ever interviewed her, she's just a really cool girl and really fun and a very good actress, and she works all the time. So it's just, I don't know, there's definitely no hard feelings on with us as people. It was more just what was kind of generated from, you know,
the fandom. Fade Out deals with an aspect of the fandom which I find fascinating. One more word on Emily. She's an Arctic air, isn't that correct, Patricia?
Yes, she is.
And that's a show that you love up there in Canada, and we want that show down here in the United States, gosh darn it. Well, the Arctic Air people follow us on Twitter, and I'm always saying, I want to see this show, and I know I could go out and download illegal copies, but we don't do that here at Wormhole Riders. And about Fade Out, you know, it's a short 8-minute film, but you cover a lot of epic facts. In reading the press release, I was like, whoa. But you picked Andrew Halliwell as one of the main themes in the movie Fade Out. How did you meet him and select his song,
Demon Haunted World?
A Demon Haunted World. How did you meet Andrew?
Andrew is a dear, dear friend of mine. He's actually worked with my husband before producing a film that Juan had made. Andrew's such a talent. Like, he produces, but he also makes music. And I had heard the song probably a couple years back when he first wrote it and put it out there, and I fell in love with it. Like, it's such a beautiful, haunting song, and there's a whole... He's a huge lover of astronomy, loves. Oh, who's that guy who wrote a book called
Carl Sagan?
Yeah, Carl Sagan. And so he read the book, and then he wanted to create kind of an album as a tribute to that book in a way. And I heard the song and I loved it. And then when I was thinking about music for Fade Out, I mean, Andrew was really the obvious choice for me to go to for music, and I listened to that song again, and I was like, this is the song. And what's interesting is that the song can be heard on so many different levels. From, I'm sure Andrew had a very specific idea to why he wrote it and what it means, but for me, when I listen to it and when I have it in the film, I think it really resonates to what the character is going through and the situation that is happening around her. So, yeah, Andrew's a very special guy. He's really great.
Well, I love the song, and I remember when it was first released, and then when you wrote me and said that this was the song that this one of, you know, there's other themes that you have in the film, but this one does resonate with Ona Grauer's character. Speaking of writing the Fade Out script, how long did you work on that script? You talked about that, like, you're wrestling with a monster. What's it like writing, and how do you discipline yourself, you know, to time manage yourself to write the script? How long did it take?
Well, you know, it's funny because short films don't really take me that long. Like, it might just be something that takes about a week or two, you know, and then you're kind of fine-tuning it. Once you get the actual structure and the skeleton of a film down, then it's very easy to sort of go back and to rearrange and to really make it something that's better. It's more feature films for me that's like wrestling with a monster. But this particular film, I think probably only took a couple of weeks, and then I kind of had it on my laptop, not really thinking about making it, because I had written other films since then. And then, you know, I approached Crystal and I sent her the script and she loved it. And so we just decided, okay, this is the one that we're going to make.
I find the subject matter to be fascinating. You know, Wormhole Riders has been around for 5 years. There was an earlier iteration in 2006 that surrounded Stargate. And when I read the press release about, quote, crazed fans and pushy managers and photographers, I thought about a kind of a paparazzi-type environment. We've had some experience with a couple people that joined us that... Well, their goal was for us to get them backstage passes, and that's not what we do here, Agam. You know, we're here to accentuate and appreciate the art of entertainment. We're not here to pass out backstage passes to people. But was the subject matter, you know, the crazed fans, the pushy managers, the photographers, was this something that was based upon a real-life experience or what you've observed in the entertainment world?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a bit of both. The film is a satire, so it kind of takes things that I've experienced and pushes it to an extreme. You know, I've been really lucky in that in my own career, I've been surrounded by a wonderful, I have a great agent and a great manager. But, you know, it's a very funny thing to be an actress. And you know, I've been doing this for 10 years. And so to kind of watch yourself on screen and to see yourself changing, you know, I don't look the same way that I did when I first started acting, you know, and so you're getting older. It's weird sometimes when you're on set and you have all these people putting makeup on you and you look amazing, and then the day's over, you go into your trailer, you take off your wig and you take off your makeup, and you're just left with yourself. You know, it's a very interesting experience. And then you also have people who really get excited to meet you and adore you, and it's wonderful, but it's sometimes can be very confusing. And so I think writing this, I didn't really have an agenda in mind. I just kind of, it was more just an inspiration. I decided that I was going to write this film. And then it just kind of took a life of its own and became what it was. But it definitely it stems from my own experiences. And then kind of pushes it to an extreme so that it's something that is a satire, and it's kind of a sad film, to be honest.
Well, you know, adding in satire is a good way to look at things in life. There are some fans. Of course, the word fan comes from fanatics, and there are some that go a little bit too far, you know, and photographers, too, that are always trying to get that paparazzi picture, right, of whoever. And, but, you know,
I think what I like about this film is that it speaks about that. It does speak about, you know, the celebrity culture and how we worship people. But I think it also speaks about what happens in our own heads, you know, like how you have this beautiful, beautiful woman who is clearly admired by so many people, but in her own mind, she just hears and sees the most awful things, you know, and it really kind of shifts back and forth between the fantasy and the reality of what's happening within our minds and in the real world. So it's interesting. To be quite honest, I don't have a clear-cut idea of what this film is about. It's about a lot of things, and I think it just depends on the people watching it to really decide what it means to them.
Well, you know, entertainment is that way. People make different connections with characters and the story arc, because it relates to their experiences in life, and I believe that Fade Out's going to resonate out there. And
thank you.
Well,
yeah, I hope so. I've been really excited for people to watch it.
Well, I think you're going to be directing some more stuff here soon, but we'll hold that. We talked about that it took 2 days to shoot the film. You know, we've done live shoots and behind-the-scenes shoots, working with the courtesy of NBC and Sci-Fi. for different programs. The shooting is one part. How hard was the editing, and how long did it take to edit Fade Out?
Well, that's a good question. You're right. Like, when people think about making a film, you just usually think about the production days. But so we shot the film in the beginning of January, and we literally finished it a few days ago. So it took about 4 months of post-production, and I think probably about 3 of those months, or at least 2.5 of those months, was editing the film. Juan Riedinger was my editor, and we edited it here in L.A., and was literally, we were doing this every single day. We would wake up and, you know, edit the film. And it was interesting to kind of tell the story again, because people say that you tell a story 3 times when you're making a movie, once when you're writing it, once when you're shooting it, and then finally when you're editing it. And I have so much respect for editors, because they can really make or break a film, you know. They really find the pace, and they can really tell the story. And that's why I'm so proud of this film, because we had an edit that we were really happy with, and then we sent it out to a handful of people just to kind of get some opinions about it and just to see what people thought. And there were all sorts of people. Some were really into film, and some were, you know, school teachers, and just to kind of see if there was anything in particular that resonated or didn't resonate. And based on some of those opinions, I took them, and I really kind of tried to see which ones hit me the most, and then went back and we edited the film again. And now I feel like it truly is finished. Like, it really is as good as it's going to be. So it was a very interesting, long experience. And I'm really, really proud of it.
Well, editing is an art. I'll date myself here. I'm 56, going to be 57 this year. I go back to the time of editing with celluloid film. Then videotape editing before there were mixing consoles. Nowadays it's a little easier with digital, but still, without a good editor, some of the best films in the world can end up being, well, not so
awful.
Good.
Yeah, it's really true. And I mean, a good editor kind of also makes, like, you can have some mistakes in things that you shot or didn't shot, and a good editor can make those into just really great choices for the film, you know. But the thing about nowadays, what you're saying, it's digital. So in some ways it's much easier, but at the same time, the rate of what's changing in terms of technology is so fast that you really have to keep up. So I think that's also a bit of a challenge, I think, sometimes as well, is that you'll have an editor who's really, really good, but unfortunately just the technology is constantly changing. So it's something that definitely requires time and patience to keep up with that.
Well, I hear you. You know, we've done a lot of video interviews and a fair amount of audios as well, and I've done a fair amount of editing myself, and keeping up on the technology is a trick. I don't profess to be as good as Mr. Riedinger, but, you know, there are some things that you get during the shoot that just don't belong in the final output. You know, there's gaps, there are bloopers, sometimes a shot is not the best angle of the celebrity that you're interviewing, and it needs to go, you know?
Yeah, and actually there was this term that I learned, editing, and Juan told me, he's like, sometimes you just gotta kill some babies. And basically what he meant by that was that you have shots that, you know, there are money shots in my head. They're like, well, this is the shot that I was like, we're going to ramp up here and, you know, go into slow-mo and it's going to be really great. But if it doesn't serve the story, which is ultimately what you're trying to do, then it needs to go, because otherwise it just doesn't feel right. And so I learned that. I think that was one of the biggest things that I learned from making this film, is that sometimes you just got to kill some babies.
I'm familiar with the term, and I agree. I mean, there are, sometimes I go back and look at raw footage that I've done and say, gosh, you know, wanted to put that in there, but it just didn't fit.
Yeah.
It wasn't part of the message, right? Or the same effect that what was desired. Agam, we want to thank you for being with the Wormhole Writers today. We have three or four more questions, and I'm going to ask Patricia to pick up on number 23. Well, I know Fade Out's going to be a success. I look forward to tweeting about it when it gets on Bravo Fact, and I'm sure that you're excited about the announcement date when it's finally made available to us.
Yes, I'm definitely thrilled, so I can't wait. I'll let you guys know.
Patricia, would you pick up on...
Yeah, I've got it, Ken.
Thanks.
Let's talk about social networking for a little bit. Lots of actors have joined Twitter, and then again, there's actors that have not shown any interest in being involved with it. And of course, being on Twitter means interacting with your fans, maybe interacting with a few nutcases, if you can call them that. But, generally doing that back and forth with individuals. Do you think that is there a good reason why some people, some actors, just really want nothing to do with it? Or what's your opinion?
Is there a reason why people, some actors, don't want to do?
Yeah, I've met some actors. I asked them why they don't do Facebook or Twitter, and they just, I get the, I don't want to be involved with that. And then there's usually an expletive at the end of that sentence. But do you have a thought on why some of them don't want to be involved in that?
Yeah, I can totally understand why they don't. For me, it's really fun. I think it's always great to kind of hear from your fans and stuff like that. But every so often you do need a break, and it sometimes feels like you just want to focus on the arts and the work as an actor, as opposed to feeling like you have to display everything on social media. And it's a fine line. Like, I think sometimes I just want to unplug, and I want to get rid of my Facebook account and my Twitter account, and I just kind of want to be sort of off the grid, just because you just want to focus on the work, on just being an actor or being an artist, and not have to really worry about the aftermath of that, or like getting the word out there of what you're doing. So I don't know, perhaps that's what they're feeling, is that they prefer to just focus on the work of being an actor as opposed to marketing themselves, because I think Twitter and Facebook and all of that, it can really feel like marketing yourself sometimes. I mean, it's a great marketing tool. And then sometimes, it really is a genuine way to kind of keep in touch with fans. So I guess it just depends on, the personality that you have and how you want to, approach your career as well.
Yeah, I agree. I do know that there are some studios that determine who they're going to choose for a particular project based on the number of followers that they have.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So do you...
I've heard that.
Does that concern you at all?
No, that doesn't concern me. No, I really believe that at the end of the day, sure, that they might choose so-and-so because they have, 50,000 followers or 100,000 followers, and that's fine, but I think at the end of the day, it's also about just being really talented, and the type of work that you want to create, and I think there's still room for that. I still think I think there is room. Sorry, I'm not being very articulate, but I do think that there is room to just be talented and to be able to just audition and do a really great job and knock people's socks off. And then they say, yeah, I want to hire that person. They may not have a Twitter account at all, or they might not be connected at all, but they're just so talented that I can't afford not to have them. So I'd like to believe that. I think for me, Twitter is just kind of a way to get in touch with fans. It's not necessarily a way to
Well, before Patricia continues with the last couple of questions, I'll leave the major star's name out, but we had met him, interviewed him at some conventions, and he swore that he would never, never get a Twitter account. and Patricia knows who I'm talking about. I have great respect for the man. And his wife, also an actress, was very active on Twitter, and we used to set up with her to harass him on stage about when he was going to get a Twitter account. And he said, my wife needs therapy, and, you know, it was a lot of tongue-in-cheek fun. But then, amazingly enough, he was involved with a major television program, and one of the requirements was that he become socially involved. And now, the guy is out there all the time cracking jokes and chatting with his fans and having a good time, which kind of leads to the next question Patricia's going to ask you about involvement.
Yeah. What advice would you give to actors to become more involved with their followers, since you're very good at it?
Oh, well, thank you. I don't know how good I am. you know, I mean, when I'm on Twitter, it's just kind of things that I find interesting and that I want to put out there, or music that I love, or projects that I'm going to be working on, or whatever. I know some people who are on Twitter and they're literally, like, every hour they're posting something. You know, I don't know. I think I really don't know if I have any good advice, except for just, like, if it interests you, then perhaps it'll interest other people. So I guess post it, you know, if it's nothing that's too personal and that you're okay with posting. But if you're somebody who prefers to be a lot more active and post every hour, then good for you, and you could do that too. I think it just depends on your personality and trying to... I agree, maybe it's not the best idea to avoid social media, but perhaps trying to find a way to make it work with your life and who you are.
Okay, well, that's very good advice. The next question is just directed to you as an individual. What do you do when you're not acting or directing or writing? And what are your plans for the near future? What are you up to next?
You know, it's funny because I feel like my work is kind of my life. So when I'm not acting, I'm usually writing something or creating some kind of project. But otherwise, if I'm not doing any of that, then I love to travel. So I like the idea of sort of playing hard and then working hard kind of thing. So if I work really, really hard and I'm, you know, writing lots of scripts or creating lots of projects, then I can reward myself with a really big trip somewhere. But in terms of what's up next, I actually I booked a series in Toronto, and so I'm going to be shooting that. I'm actually leaving tomorrow morning, actually. I'm going to be going to Toronto. I start shooting on the 29th, and I'm really excited about it. I'm going to be there for about 13 episodes, so it's going to take me till about middle of September, and I'm thrilled. There's not a lot I can actually say about it because they haven't done the official press release, but it's a drama. It's a 1-hour drama, and I'm going to be doing it in a series.
Well, that'll be lots of fun for you, and I'm looking forward to seeing what it's all about. Hopefully, whatever it is, they end up being able to see in the United States and not just in Canada. But don't forget to bring your long underwear and your nice woolen hat.
Yes, thanks. That's really good advice.
Toronto is a wonderful city. Shooting this time of the year, well, the winter seems to have gone a little longer this year in Canada, hasn't it, Patricia?
Yes, it has. In fact, we haven't seen spring since quite a while, so, yeah.
maybe you
I know, that's what I hear. I hear that it's been a really cold, really, really cold spring, so I'm supposed to be bringing my winter jacket.
We're all mad at the groundhogs up here.
Maybe you should bring some nubbins with you. They can heat things up, Agam. We wish you the very best of luck. in your new series. I think we know what it is, but we're not going to put it out as a spoiler. You make an announcement, and of course, the Twitterverse will explode with joy when you do. And you can count on a couple of retweet Twitter spams from us as well.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I can't wait. I'm sure this week I'll be able to actually finally tell people. I've been holding this secret in for a while.
Well, non-disclosure and, discretion is the better part of valor. And in the entertainment industry, wouldn't you agree that that is a critical part of success in the industry?
That's true. That's
really the duct tape on the mouth until the paperwork and all that stuff is taken care of.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, Agam Darshi, for all the Wormhole Riders fans all over the world, for Goopy Nubbin, Sanctuary Angel, Pumpkin Nubbin, Johnny Doomsday Johnny, Claire Cohen, for sending in the questions. There was one question that came in on the blog, and I just checked it. Gosh darn it. It's from, we have a very shy Twitter follower. He never wants his account name out there, so I'm not going to do it. It's kind of a follow-on, and the question is, obviously you still want to act. That was part of his question. Will you be directing, and are you writing more screenplays now? This is from Gene, our shy follower. I can't give out his email address or his Twitter account, or he'll kill me. Are you writing more screenplays?
I am, yeah. Actually, me and my writing partner, Lena Monroe, we're writing a feature right now that is going to be pretty fun. So stay tuned for that.
Well, Agam, we want to thank you for spending about an hour and a half with us. So we know you're getting ready to get on a plane to go to Toronto. Safe travels. And from all the Wormhole Riders out there, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, guys. You guys are really awesome, and I just really appreciate the support and talking to you. It's been really fun.
Thank you very much, Agam. Mm-hmm.